Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're at the library tomorrow. We are not there Wednesday. It's our staff retreat. We're joined now on Zoom by food policy analyst, multiple James Beard winner, Corby Kummer. He's executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at the Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hello there, Corby Kummer.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Hello, hey. Corby Kummer. So we have seen a lot of this on the road, being cut off by food delivery people working for Uber Eats and DoorDash and all these kinds of things. But they have a tough life, too. So tell us about the delivery drivers, as the Globe put it, getting squeezed from all sides.
Terrific piece by Katie Johnson and Anthony Jimenez in the Globe. Really comprehensive. One of the best pieces I've seen about the plight of DoorDash and Uber Eats delivery people, especially on mopeds. And there's a lot to complain about in terms of unregistered mopeds allowed to use the bike lanes and going to kill people, women in strollers and all that. But shining a light on the plight of the drivers. First of all, the idea that they really made the headline right in the Globe when they said a 23-minute ride for $3.52. So this is typical. That's what the software serves up to the drivers. The drivers are often immigrants. They're often undocumented. They don't want to risk being deported or not being able to work further. And so it quoted one woman, a car backed into her moped, totaled it or certainly wrecked it, and she just left the scene because she didn't want to try to make a claim which would finger her and she would come to the attention she didn't want. So Uber Eats provides some protection for personal injury for the actual drivers, but little to none for injury for others, which will fall on the drivers. The drivers are not insured. There's got to be more regulation for these mopeds. We've discussed on the show before the idea that they don't have to have licenses, especially if they're on scooters. And so there's no way for a pedestrian who's like clocked by one of these things or knocked down to be able to complain to the authorities. So it's bad on all sides.
You know, the one thing I don't understand is what you're talking about, the regulation thing. Ride sharing companies are regulated by the state, but delivery companies, which to me are just a variation on a theme, are not. Is there any rationale for regulating one and not regulating the other?
Oh, I'm sure it's because citizens who vote are the passengers as opposed to bags of food in boxes. And so the state is trying to protect voters and, you know, human lives, but not necessarily the human lives of the people who are desperate to make a living.
By the way, you should really read, people who haven't read this piece yet, it really is worth a read if you not only are using these services, but you care about your fellow human beings.
Well, you know, they gave really a depressing
statistic
in here, talking about a driver has had an order from a noodle shop in Chinatown, 23-minute drive to Dorchester, goes from Chinatown to Dorchester, and that he earns $3.52. I mean, that was just really, really upsetting to read. So, Corby Kummer, I think we could all agree seasonal eating is wonderful. Tell us a little bit more about it.
So there's a log piece that says, as if it is news, try buying what's in season. It's cheaper. It's got better flavor. There's more of it. This is all true. It's a piece backing the Mediterranean diet. It's funny because it's back in fashion. Never really been out of fashion, the Mediterranean diet, but the New York Times ran a whole month-long series about why it's good to eat the Mediterranean diet. And it is good, but as one of my students at Tufts Friedman wrote last term, how do you make it culturally appropriate for African Americans? You know, where's the black access to the Mediterranean diet, or tally it, make it correlate to the diets people grew up with? So, okay, before we get away from that, why is it good? Because you get cheaper fruits and vegetables, more of them for less money, and it broadens out your diet. So I think it's great to eat seasonally. And it adds variety to your diet. But part of the rationale in this piece about why it's so good is going to Sicily, where people live to 100 and they eat the Mediterranean diet. And it quotes an 89-year-old woman who says she only cooks from scratch and eats everything vegetarian, and her good health is adjusting to what's available throughout the year. So, great. not everybody can do that. Not everybody knows how to cook that stuff. And even though it does add variety, you know, asparagus, peaches, soon to be cherries, things that you don't see all the time that you look forward to the rest of the year. It's great to associate food with a certain season and then not eat it the rest of the year. But even though it adds variety, it also tends to add a sameness to your diet. If all you eat is what's in season, you tend to eat less of it because anytime you restrict your diet to a set of ingredients or a set of food, you kind of get tired of it and you eat less of it. So, you know, there's many good things about it, but there was sort of a broader picture I wanted to talk about.
So I eat mountains of broccoli. Broccoli's, I assume, not seasonal because it's, why are you making fun
Jimmy's
of me?
Mountains of
I like broccoli.
Broccoli.
You don't like broccoli?
How many people can say they eat mountains
well,
of broccoli?
I love broccoli.
I do like broccoli.
I like the texture.
Mountains,
I like the taste.
Maybe not mountains.
Maybe not mountains. Hills.
Hillocks.
Bumps. I eat bumps of broccoli. Is that, what are they growing that like in a hot, what are those things called? Hot houses?
They are a relative of the cabbage and they're very hardy and you can often grow them in winter.
Oh,
so
okay.
They're not particularly seasonal. They've okay. been bred to be very resistant. Broccoli is great. It's a nutritional powerhouse and you should be eating hillocks, mountains, you know, rivers, streams, whatever it takes. Keep eating all that stuff. And you know, this piece said, look beyond the broccoli and onions in your market.
If so one last question.
Let me just clarify this, because you...
Mountains of broccoli.
In some seasons, I eat bumps of broccoli. Others, larger hills. And then, yeah, exactly. In some seasons,
I do eat
mountains of broccoli.
Is there a broccoli season?
No, we just had this discussion.
Yeah.
That's the whole point.
It's not.
Are you here for this?
Yeah, but
no season. Eat
no
it all
season.
Year.
Okay, but
it's a hearty thing. You can cook. He said something about eating, growing in
winter.
I have
another question.
Okay, go ahead.
So things like peaches and nectarines, which I associate with the summertime, cantaloupes and stuff, you can buy them all year. But you're saying that they are more juicy and fresher in the summer.
I am saying that.
Okay.
Wow,
that's
bold.
True. And anything that you could get at the Copley Square Farmers Market or, you know, the government center, wherever you go to a farmer's market. Stone fruits are pretty rare in the Northeast, and whether it be early frosts or way too hot weathers that burn it, have dealt, you know, not, in fact, death blows to the plums, apricots, and peaches that grow in the Northeast, and sour cherries, especially, and cherries. But berries have been doing well. Yes, whenever you find it locally, buy it.
Okay.
Do you remember when the whole peach crop in Massachusetts was destroyed last year because of one day of early frost?
It was
or
horrible.
Some such thing? Have we discussed broccoli in this? We did discuss broccoli.
Mountains of broccoli.
Okay, can we discuss oxtail? By the way, I'm betting that Marjorie wouldn't know oxtail if she fell over it.
I don't know anything about oxtail.
I love oxtail.
That's
what
why
is
we're asking Corby.
Let's start there. What is oxtail, Corby Comer?
I have actually cooked oxtail. It is the tail of a steer. It's right there. It's got bones, cartilage, and tons of fat.
Ugh.
And the reason it's so really good for you is that it's really fattening and it's really high in cholesterol. So you can't have it, you know, very much of it. And it's also much more expensive than beef or brisket. There's less of it, like a couple of pounds per
like 8 pounds per cow or whatever you call those
29 pounds of brisket. Yeah. But it's really good because all of that fat, all of that cartilage adds sheen, gloss and beautiful fat and flavor to a stew. It's especially popular in Jamaican and Caribbean food, also Mexican. And it's great. It just happens to have caught on recently.
Why is it caught on recently?
Because cooks in like burger joints in Texas and California and even the Northeast, jerk chicken caught on. This is part of the same phenomenon, are simply adding it to their stews or putting kind of as if it's chopped brisket. They're chopping up oxtail and using it on their burgers. And what does it do? It adds fat. It adds unctuous lusciousness.
Huge flavor.
It's a great idea to have on a burger if you aren't counting calories and cholesterol.
The only thing, Marjorie, if you have it on a burger, you have to spit the bone out.
And all the fatty parts.
The bone. You don't eat the bone.
No, I know you don't eat the bone.
It's the meat falls off the bone.
That's why a lot of people don't like steak like me, because it's all full of fat.
Really?
Mm.
Okay, Marjorie.
Okay. Let's move on to something that is not full of fat.
Why'd you stick your tongue out? That was a little
rude. Because the idea of gristle, as you used to call it, gristle.
Gristle is bad.
Yeah, gristle is bad. Gristle is the same thing as fat.
I have to tell you.
What?
No, first of all, gristle is not the same as fat.
It's not?
Gristle is a hard-to-digest fat-like thing. But fat, like on a ribeye or something like that, doesn't do it for you?
No, it does not.
Oxtail?
No, oxtail. Okay, I don't think so. I'm not going there.
Okay.
However,
market for grass-fed local beef because it's so much less fatty. You should only be buying from Massachusetts producers of grass-fed beef.
Marjorie.
Where do you get that?
You could get it at Whole Foods. There were community-supported agricultures that just for meat that often show up at farmers markets, and they have freezer cases, instead of an ice cream case and a little rolling freezer cart, they've got meat. Go to your farmers market and find it.
Okay. I think one of our staff says Walden Meats. There you go. I've never heard of it, but maybe that's where we should be going. All right, here's something that sounds kind of neat to me. Fire chicken noodles, South Korean dish, and apparently talking about catching fire, literally and figuratively, they are going viral and making millions.
Well, I don't really believe that it appeals to you, Marjorie, because it scares even Koreans who are talking about
it. Oh, it does?
It's so hot.
Okay. All right. I take it back.
It caught on because it's part of this youth challenge. And, when I say youth, I'm talking about teenagers who love to take risks and challenge themselves and learn their own limits. And the 14-year-old Massachusetts boy chip challenge.
Who died.
Yeah, right. And I'll sound incredibly old when I say this is really unappealing, but huge TikTok phenomenon. 360 million posts on TikTok of people who are either reacting to or posting their own reactions to buying these ramen packages that have a ton of spice and heat in them and showing what it's like, the faces they make when they put boiling water on and eat them. What I particularly was interested in this piece by Kelly Cho in the Washington Post is that the whole idea of Korean noodle dishes is a kind of American post-World War II exports because the war decimated so many rice fields.
Oh.
Koreans couldn't grow traditional rice, which is what they ate as a starch. And so the U.S. started exporting cheap flour, and the government had a publicity campaign to say, start adding flour to your traditional native food. It's always really bad when governments try to change indigenous traditions, I think. But this is like a U.S. surplus phenomenon of food ingredients that started the whole noodle craze in Korea in the 50s and 60s.
Okay.
Okay, here's the big question of the day, Corby. When was the last time you ate dog food?
I've attempted to eat dog food.
Well,
you did?
And for good reason. Why would you be tempted to eat dog food in 2024, Corby Comer?
Because, about every week or so, there's a piece about the absurd amounts of money that Americans are spending on their pets.
Correct.
And it really skyrocketed during the pandemic because of COVID dogs and COVID pets. But apparently, this trend has not abated since 2022 when it started really coming up. And so José Andrés has an entire Mediterranean-inspired dog food brand called Real Mesa. And there are, grass-fed meat, or these kinds of free-range chicken that are going into stews. And so a writer for The Atlantic named Ellen Cushing, I think she's a recent hire, a staff writer, decided, this looks pretty good. I'm going to have some in a frozen pouch. And what she said was really interesting, that it tasted like a sort of bland soup, but with plenty of fresh vegetables and meat in it. And she thought, okay, it's, I like more sodium. This brand is controlling the sodium for your pet, but I'd eat it. It's just fine. So there's this new treat your dog right. I say that it's echoing a really good book by Marion Nestle called Feed Your Pet Right. She, before the pandemic, caught on to this trend. For example, Mars Foods, Colossus, a giant, it has tons of candy bars and Snickers and M&Ms. Their biggest business is pet food. They have Purina, I think it's Purina, they have Purina Pet Chow. It's an enormous business. It's hugely profitable globally. And so, you know, gourmet extensions to the lines for people who really want to coddle their pets is a completely logical thing.
Okay,
well,
so
listen to this. What? Listen to this description, though. Yellowfin tuna,
yeah,
caught in the Atlantic, yeah, gently steamed and packed with fresh water, mm-hmm, it, for $6 a tin, which is more than regular human being tuna costs.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that sounds like you could eat it, right?
Except you don't eat tuna.
I do eat tuna.
No, you don't eat tuna.
Well,
like,
I mix it and, you know.
No, they're not talking about tuna fish in a can. They're talking about like tuna, like tuna,
well,
like a piece of tuna.
Okay. It's, well, that's what you say, but it's gently steamed and packed with fresh water. I mean,
oh,
that doesn't sound like it's terrible. It sounds like it's a human being.
So you
going to
eat
food.
It? We're going to ask listeners in a minute.
I'm not going to eat it, but it doesn't sound much different than what a for the third time, what a person would eat.
Now, all of the examples in this article of ingredients list that they give, there's nothing that's a danger zone for humans.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, are there danger zones for humans in the other stuff they make?
Yeah, but they, you know what she never answers is, even if it's okay, whatever that means, why do you want to eat dog food? How about that, Corby? Multiple James Beard Award winner.
Because I've been parachuted into the middle of nowhere. I had no meals ready to eat from the U.S. military, but I was able to get pet food in a vacuum pouch that would keep for a long time. And it was made with fresh, high-quality ingredients. And it's what I found at the market before I went to the plane. That
no, Marjorie, with. It did not happen. You have a look on your face. He didn't parachute in. He's saying, here's a circumstance in which I would eat dog
okay
food. He didn't parachute in anything.
I was shocked there momentarily.
You should have seen the look on her face. I mean, oh, my God.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, last question, because you really haven't answered it directly. You are not parachuting into anything. You were assigned, let's say, by the Atlantic, for example, to go eat dog food. Would you do it, yes or no, Corby Kummer?
I would, because I think it's safe for human consumption.
Okay.
I would look on the can to see if it was, and it would be kind of no better and no worse than a lot of canned food.
What be your yeah,
did
what
you
would be your choice?
To the desserts they have? I mean,
no.
This dessert sounds great.
Okay, good.
They have gluten-free pumpkin biscuits.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That's
yeah
what I
freeze-dried purple sweet potato or corn-free, wheat-free macaroons, mm-hmm, in flavors like creme brulee and lavender.
By the way, the
yeah
only
I love
thing
creme
you know
brulee.
That's too frou-frou even for me.
Can I tell you
so,
something?
You know,
what
I
that Cushing
happen
woman didn't say in her piece is when she ate out of a bowl on the floor, which really is a
yeah
photograph.
If you had
I
to lick the creme brulee, that you'd be there a long time.
Did I ever tell you when my older daughter, this is a true story, my older daughter was really young, mm-hmm, like really young, and she wouldn't drink milk. This is a true story. We, you know what we do? We put it in a bowl on the floor. Honest, I never told you this. And she would lick the milk out of the bowl. Honest to God. And it got her drinking milk. And then she loves milk. Good story, Jim. Thank you.
Very good
anything
story
else you want to say or no?
Yeah, I have a better story, but it will take like 40 seconds.
Go ahead. We can give it to you.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was once at our family house in Northern Connecticut with my brother and his two young kids.
Yeah.
We're having Friday night dinner in which there was fresh broccoli. It was, you know,
oh,
pre-gym before there were, you know, it was a tiny little mountain in the middle of the table. The next day, my brother, the father of these children, and I were having a frank and useful exchange, as brothers do.
Yeah.
And I said, will you just give in on this point? And he said, I will if you will never eat with your fingers in front of my children again.
Wow.
Do you know what an example you were setting for them? They correct our table manners. And I said, I've been hanging out with food people. We eat with our fingers.
Well, Corby.
Let me just say, that has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking
do
about.
Do you
but
lick
it's
your
a
fingers
fabulous
what,
story
you know, at the end of the meal, or do you use a napkin?
No, I was reaching in because it was steamed broccoli. There was nothing on it. It was perfectly fine. But anyway, I would get on the floor and eat, especially if it were at a party and there were no kids.
Next time we see you, we will provide a bowl on the floor and put you to the test. Corby Kummer, good to see you as always.
Thank you, Corby. We've been speaking with food policy analyst Corby Kummer. He's executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy.